Coming up on Fronteras, more cities, including Austin, are considering municipal ID cards, partly with undocumented immigrants in mind. New Haven, Connecticut was a leader when it issued resident cards years ago.
It was used as student IDs in our high schools. It was used as a library card. It was used to be able to access recreation services.
Former New Haven Mayor John DeStefano on how these municipal IDs work there and what other communities can learn. Also on the program, we'll look at drones that can help save lives during a disaster by providing Wi-Fi.
We can dispatch the drones maybe just in 20 minutes and then send Wi-Fi internet access such that people can transmit their real-time information back to the rescue team, and the rescue team can send the information and say, we're here, just hold on a second.
More on these drones being developed in North Texas on Fronteras. First, the news. This is Fronteras, the journalism project that brings you stories from the U.S.-Mexico border region. Fronteras is possible through the collaboration of several public radio stations in border states. In San Antonio, I'm Crystal Chavez. Texas lawmakers in charge of putting together the state's budget for the upcoming legislative session are searching for more funding for the state-led multi-million dollar border security operation. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy reports lawmakers are also looking at how to replace money already spent for that effort.
Texas Governor Rick Perry's activation of the National Guard has prompted members of the Senate's Finance Committee to review the money already being spent to begin the Guard's training. Houston Democratic State Senator Sylvia Garcia questioned Ursula Parks from the Legislative Budget Board on how the state pays for the initiative when the Texas National Guard's state budget is roughly about $15 million a year. Their deployment is expected to cost $12 million a month.
How do they get money to pay for the hotel costs and transportation and fuel and salaries and all the other things that they've got to pay for?
I think that there are some other mechanisms that might be available to help address these costs. One of them would be a disaster declaration on the part of the governor.
Park says the governor's office could continue to shift money between state funds, a tactic the governor has already used to kick off the Guard's training. But lawmakers are concerned about replacing those funds during the upcoming 2015 legislative session. Major General John Nichols is the head of the Texas National Guard and says without appropriate funding, the Guard could have to come back prematurely.
If there was no funding found at a certain date, probably around the 15th of October, then we would start retrograding some of the folks back.
As far as federal reimbursement, Nichols says based on past experiences, he doesn't believe the state will be reimbursed. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
More cities are considering municipal IDs, including the city of Austin. This is in part with immigrants who aren't in the country legally in mind. To see just what impact these municipal IDs can have, we called up the former mayor of New Haven, Connecticut, John DeStefano. New Haven was the first city to create a resident card of this kind.
Sure. In 2007, when I was mayor of New Haven, New Haven rolled out the first municipal ID card that, while available for all residents, particularly also had in mind its applicability to undocumented residents of our community.
What exactly does a municipal ID have on it?
Well, you know, municipal IDs are not new things. A lot of communities have had them for very long times to use recreational facilities or for other programs. The New Haven resident ID card was to demonstrate conclusively two things: who someone is and where they live. And to do that, we fundamentally use the documentation that the Internal Revenue Service of the United States government uses to issue a tax ID number. So to demonstrate who you are, we would use either a birth certificate, a consular document, a visa, a passport, and to demonstrate where you live, a utility bill, a lease, something like that. And the card was prepared with indicia, which is a kind of stamping and security that we previewed with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Connecticut, and again, to make sure that it couldn't be duplicated.
And you mentioned that this was done with undocumented immigrants in mind. What does this provide for them?
Well, the first thing we did is, while it was done with the undocumented community in mind, the card was meant to have utility and use for all residents of the community. of New Haven, both documented and undocumented. So it was used as student IDs in our high schools. It was used as a library card. It was used to be able to access recreation services in New Haven. And with undocumented residents in mind, it was had a particular utility as we engaged that community to be able to demonstrate to police who folks were, to use it as identification to open a bank account, and for just other practical applications that in many states and communities a driver's license would be used for.
One thing we hear is that people who are undocumented often don't report crimes because of fear of deportation. Did this have any positive effect in police-community relations of any kind?
The genesis of the New Haven Elm City resident card was really in 2005 in a series of meetings held between city officials and the immigrant community. When I say the immigrant community, in this case, it was both documented and undocumented. These meetings were hosted by the Catholic Church in New Haven because many of the undocumented community have had experiences with police in their native countries that were not particularly positive and supportive. For us, as we engaged the community, a lot of our concern in city government had to do with public safety. We were seeing undocumented residents, oftentimes the victim of street crime. Folks would presume something from facial characteristics about country of origin, that if they were undocumented, they were probably carrying large amounts of cash or had access to large amounts of cash at home. They became the victims of street crime. In addition, what we also were seeing is that because the undocumented community oftentimes did not have positive relationships with police, that the card was a vehicle to, along with some other initiatives, to begin to build trusting community relationships with the police so that if someone was a victim of street crime or domestic abuse or something else, that they would feel comfortable interacting with police. That said, I would also acknowledge that the introduction of the card in New Haven was preceded by the issuance of a general order in the, with the New Haven Police Department that basically said unless someone the police were talking to was a suspect of a felony activity, we did not inquire as to legal status in residency in New Haven.
You may have heard there are some Texas cities that are considering creating their own municipal IDs, but this did come with some backlash, at least initially over there. Is that right?
In New Haven in 2007, when we went to issue the card, which required getting a grant from a foundation to fund the card and the activity the city would have to undertake attended to issuing the card, we had to get approval of our legislative body to accept these grant funds. That became a platform for people who were angry with the nation's immigration policies or lack thereof. And we were sort of like, look, you know, Washington can't get its act together. Of course, now that was 2005, 9 years ago. It still hasn't gotten its act together. And we were like, you know, whatever they do in Washington, they got to figure that out. They're not doing it. We need to make New Haven a safe, welcoming place for members of our community. There was some backlash. They were largely people who were not from New Haven that were articulating their views on national immigration policy, which is fine, but really didn't have to do with how do we build a community where neighbors know who each other are, where people accept the responsibilities, obligations, as well as benefits of living in a civil society. So, yeah, we did have some opposition. That said, in 2013, when the Connecticut General Assembly for the state of Connecticut made Connecticut driver's licenses available to the undocumented community, there wasn't much debate about that. And I think what had happened is sort of New Haven in 2005 and 2007 was the crucible or the platform for those angers and points of views. And people sort of recognized by 2013 when the legislature acted on behalf of the entire state that it wasn't such a big deal, and they move forward with issuing licenses without a lot of noises.
So now anyone in Connecticut, regardless of legal status, can get a driver's license?
As long as they meet the other requirements of age and ability to drive, that everybody, and insurance that everybody else has to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, for us, it was part of just engaging people who are here, who are working here, whose kids are going to school here, whose many members of their family are documented appropriately here. You know, we also did it encouraging folks to open bank accounts, to go to the IRS, get a tax ID number. IRS doesn't care about your immigration status. They want you to pay taxes, so we were encouraging them to pay taxes and fulfill, not only enjoy the benefits of living in community, but to meet the obligations and responsibilities of living in a community.
And now that we're in 2014, you've seen the impacts of what ID for everyone means. What would you say to leaders and communities that are now considering doing the same?
Let Washington battle out the big issues, and someday they'll get around to fixing the system. Recognize that immigration is not just a long-trusted value of our nation, but has been critical and key to growing the wealth and economy of the nation, that communities are being left to resolve these issues for themselves, and it makes sense to know who's living in our communities, and to just frankly do this in the sense where we're not creating a special benefit. Well, we're applying the same standards of rights and obligations of living in and community to everybody.
That was former New Haven, Connecticut Mayor John DeStefano talking about municipal IDs. A brand new event tips its hat to a San Antonio tradition from well over 100 years ago. Texas Public Radio's arts and culture reporter Jack Morgan has more.
It's called Mujeres Mercado, which in Spanish means women's market, which actually makes sense given that
we're really promoting and pushing an all-female artisan market.
That's the main Plaza Conservancy's Ashley Quinn, and that's where Mujeres Mercado is happening. The actual concept is what they call a night market.
A night market is a vibrant space filled with vendors of all different types of items. None of it is retail. It's all 100% handmade. And on top of that, it's based upon traditions that have been passed down through their generations, you know, great-grandmothers, grandmothers, moms.
It'll be 7 through 11 every third Saturday through December, starting this Saturday night. Of course, Saturday night on Main Plaza also features that amazing video projected onto San Fernando Cathedral.
We'll have different variety of food trucks out there. We will have organic beer and wine for purchase. So we're really trying to create this really awesome urban downtown experience.
The Mujeres Mercado pays homage to the Chili Queens tradition that flourished in the main plaza from the 1860s through the 1930s.
There's also traditional healers that will be on site, and they're all certified. It's giving an option to get off the Riverwalk, experience a new part of downtown, and experience something real.
It's a Mujeres Mercado, but the hombres are welcome as well, right?
Absolutely welcome. Are you kidding? And we definitely support the men who support our women.
We have more on the Mujeres Mercado at TPR.org. Jack Morgan, Texas Public Radio News.
Coming up on Fronteras, drones that can help save lives during a disaster by providing Wi-Fi access.
We can dispatch the drones maybe just in 20 minutes and then send Wi-Fi internet access such that people can transmit their real-time information back to the rescue team, and the rescue team can send the information and say, we're here, just hold on a second.
More on these drones being developed in North Texas when Fronteras returns. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Drones have gotten international notoriety. Sometimes they're described as killing machines. But drones can also save lives. As part of KERA's Breakthroughs series, Lauren Silverman visits two University of North Texas professors who've developed a drone for emergencies. It's capable of providing Wi-Fi to storm-ravaged areas where telephone access is out.
Hovering 20 feet in the air is something that sounds like a beehive and looks like a spider. But this 5-pound drone is nothing to fear. In fact, it could be a lifesaver.
The first 1 minute, the first half hour, the first 1 hour is critical. to save lives.
Shenli Fu, along with UNT professor Yan Wan, created this drone to deliver Wi-Fi to victims at disaster sites, like earthquakes or tornadoes, where communication systems have been knocked out.
We can dispatch the drones maybe just in 20 minutes, and then send Wi-Fi internet access such that people can transmit their real-time information back to the rescue team, and the rescue team can send the information and say, we're here, just hold on a second.
Most Wi-Fi networks transmit a signal that spans only 100 meters, about the length of a football field. This drone can send Wi-Fi up to 3,000 meters. That ability comes from two directional antennas that focus all the energy in one direction. See, the flying drone has to always have its antenna, which looks sort of like a remote control, facing a control center in a safe place. That can be challenging if storm winds are jostling the drone around. So Juan created an antenna that rotates to always align with the control center.
So even if the drone is turning, for example, when there's strong wind, right, but you will see the direction is not going to be affected.
This six-legged creation is part of a larger White House Presidential Innovation Fellows project to create smart emergency response systems. See, when disasters strike, there's an enormous cost. In the U.S., a year of fire damage amounts to more than $300 billion. Katrina cost $1 trillion in direct and indirect damage. So the White House has brought together researchers from universities like UNT, MIT, and companies like National Instruments and Boeing to brainstorm. Andy Chang with National Instruments says, at first, the ideas were a bit outlandish.
One of the researchers actually specialized in cockroaches, if you would believe it. So he had talked about, you know, hey, it might be possible for us to deploy hundreds of cockroaches in a disaster situation to help identify the condition for all the subjects they're in.
Cockroaches were eventually beat out by man's best friend and robotic systems like drones and unmanned vehicles. National Instruments is working with the University of Washington to incorporate a vehicle it programmed to help the city of Seattle respond to emergencies, like the mudslide that killed more than 40 people in March.
We were very excited to be able to kind of work with those guys and understand the requirements and figuring out, okay, are these things really just science fictions, or can we actually improve some of the elements that would really help the firefighter and the search and rescue team in a real life scenario?
It's still early for these projects, and battery life is a big concern. Right now, the battery for that 5-pound flyer lasts just 20 minutes or so, which means UNT researchers Wan and Fu may have to design a lighter vehicle. Beyond technical obstacles, there's regulatory hurdles. The Federal Aviation Administration has put stricter rules on commercial use of drones, which is why Fu is working with emergency agencies and the military.
With this, their help, we can measure the designs, and then we can show FAA it's safe, it's low cost, it's very valuable for even civilian usage.
The collaboration among universities, corporations, and the government is just getting started. The technologies probably won't be ready for the next disaster, but you might want to get comfortable hearing this sound. Lauren Silverman, KERA News.
More public art has been unveiled down on the Mission Reach in San Antonio. Texas Public Radio's arts and culture reporter Jack Morgan tells us more about it.
The Mission Reach continues to peel back the metaphorical public art onion, and on Monday, a pair of Vincent Valdez art installations were revealed, two benches, sponsored by the San Antonio River Foundation.
It was a chance for me to share my work with the public, with the community and the city of San Antonio, and part of this amazing project that they're doing.
This amazing project, you're talking about the Mission Reach?
Right, and you know, I think it's exciting to see, for me as a citizen of San Antonio, to see how much the public is already getting outside, walking with their pets, running, jogging, and just spending time outside, learning more about nature, ecology.
The origin of the idea of his rectangular steel benches is surprising.
The concept was sparked by the opening sequence of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey, where the primitive cavemen encountered this minimalist black monolithic form. I was seeing it as a metaphor, a symbolism for San Antonio today. We seem to be a city that's rapidly changing, but we're a city that embraces the past, and we somehow force the two to coexist. The old school meets the new school.
Those steel benches represent the jet black rectangle that so perplexed the cavemen. but in a very colorful way.
I took two old serapes that my grandmother passed down to me years ago.
Serapes are brightly colored traditional Mexican blankets.
Embedded them into the actual benches, and here we see the old meets the new.
He digitally recorded and produced the colorful blankets as the bench tops, and the results are bright and inviting. And they're so realistic, you have to reach out with your hands to be sure they're not actually a blanket.
They're very modern looking, but at the same time, they're low and slow, like the old classic lowriders in the South Side.
And what these benches say to me isn't Minneapolis or Columbus, Ohio or someplace. It says San Antonio.
It's very much San Antonio. You know, I think that for me personally, it very much reflects, you know, my own upbringing here, my background growing up in the South Side community.
The benches are a few hundred yards north of the Confluence Park parking lot, a little past Mitchell Avenue, and about 100 feet from the San Antonio River. They face one another and out to nature, which is no accident.
The idea was also to leave them open-ended with no backing so that you can face inwards and outwards. And so that was sort of the idea in terms of forcing the sitters to become interactive.
While Valdez is one of the city's most successful artists, he's new to public art.
So it's a big change for me because most of the times as a painter, the works go straight from the easel into private collections or museums where, you know, not as much of the public has access to them at all times. And so it was a really nice opportunity.
And he's dropping hints that his public art is just beginning.
And so now I've got these concepts underway for future projects that are going to actually force the public to interact with my own work. And so, yeah, I'm very excited about where that leads me.
Are you going to give us any specifics, or is it still pretty general at this point?
It's going to be hidden gems and surprises that I'm going to, that people, that San Antonians are going to find at random points and at random areas throughout the city.
As the Mission Reach arts continue to be revealed, we'll keep you informed. I took several pictures of the benches and of Valdez. You can see them and see other arts and culture stories at tpr.org. Jack Morgan, Texas Public Radio News.
Fronteras is a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the Latino demographic. It's a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. You can find the entire audio for this program and past shows at tpr.org. Share these stories with your friends on social media. We have one-click buttons to Facebook and Twitter. The theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. In San Antonio, I'm Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.